You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 14th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
A lonely man.
And Evan Bernstein.
You know what happened on this day in 2003?
No idea.
No.
The dwarf planet Sedna was discovered.
Really?
I think they prefer to call it the little person planet.
The little person's planet.
Sorry, was that wrong? Are we going to get an angry letter about that? We might.
We might.
Sorry.
Sure.
Happy birthday, Sedna. You're 4 years old, as far as Earth is concerned.
Way to bring him back there, Evan.
Thank you.
Did any of you clowns see Judgment Day on PBS this week?
I missed it.
I can't believe I missed it.
I have it on TiVo. It's very good. I watched the whole thing.
Yeah. I caught bits of it, but if you missed it, you can watch it on Nova's website for free.
Yes.
So nice.
The whole thing is going to be up there on Friday.
I don't like watching TV on my computer.
That's all I do is watch TV on my computer.
Yeah, but I got a 50-inch high-definition TV downstairs. I don't like watching on a 20-inch.
Bob, you have to do what I do. You hook up a computer to your TV.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Don't make us take away your nerd badge.
I know that your TV has a VGA input for that you can go from your computer. But anyway, you should watch it in some way. I did watch it. It was very, very good. I mean, you know, you can only drill down so deep on the issues, and even in a two-hour program, but they did a very good job. So this, of course, was a documentary that we talked about last week covering the Kitzmiller versus Dover intelligent design trial of 2005, where the intelligent design proponents were crushed by the evolution proponents. This was over a school board trying to insinuate the teaching of intelligent design into the public science classroom in Dover, Pennsylvania. And it was presided over by Judge John E. Jones III. And the decision was that intelligent design is religion and cannot be taught in the Dover public school system. So it was an excellent outcome. And the documentary did an excellent job they interviewed a lot of the people there, including creationists and intelligent design proponents, and let them make their own points. I think that they were fair, but they did not try for this false balance, you know, where you try to make it seem like the two sides are equal.
Good.
They clearly came down on the in the favor of evolution and the conclusion that intelligent design is not science. So it was very good, and they had some good animations and went over some of the key pieces of evidence that was presented.
Good animations and what? People evolving, or what do you animate on a show like that?
the bacterial flagellum
and the more
primitive structures that from which it probably evolved, for example. It was a good illustration, made the key points. Anybody watching that would get some of the key points about why intelligent design is, you know, warmed over creationism, and why its proponents are intellectually dishonest, and why it is not science. So I think that in the end, it was a good show. A couple of points I thought they let go by without addressing more directly. You could, you know, for example, put bacteria in a petri dish and let them evolve or let them reproduce for 10,000 generations and see if they develop a flagellum or something like it, and that would be a way to falsify intelligent design. And again, they kind of let that one go by without explaining why that is complete nonsense, why that does not make ID testable. They also say that's because it's really just a moving goalpost type of proposition. It's like, well, make evolution happen in a test tube, and then that would falsify intelligent design. But making unreasonable, you know, requests for evidence does not render your theory falsifiable. They also say, for example, that if every tiny little gap in our knowledge of how everything living evolved were completely fleshed out, then that would also falsify intelligent design.
Oh, that's all we got to do?
That's all. Okay. That's it. We just got to close every single gap, no matter how minute. And until we've done that, we haven't really proven evolution. So therefore, we have to default to intelligent design.
Steve, how did you gauge the tone of the program?
Wait, hang on. I got to puke. Wait. All right. It passed.
Okay. It was good, Jay. It was very rational, very pro science. It was like it was Nova, and Nova, you know, is unashamedly pro science. They're not, you know, it's good journalism, good science journalism. They did a good job, and the guys who were defending their creationism, you know, they just let them talk and basically hang themselves by saying ridiculous stuff. They didn't have to really go characterize their positions in a negative way. They just had to interview them and let them characterize their own positions. So it was good. I wrote my blog entry today about a piece of the show because they actually had a segment on Tiktaalik, you know, which is the transitional fossil between fish and amphibians, because the Tiktaalik fossil was discovered during this trial, and it's an excellent, excellent example of a transitional fossil. So I wrote my blog about that today. And a listener of the show was sent that to a creationist friend of theirs, and he wrote back addressing the points that I made in my blog. And we're going to go over that in the Name That Logical Fallacy segment this week. So we'll come back to that in Name That Logical, because he just... You know, just
that
wonderful.
Pretty much says it right
you
there.
Have to read this email. I'll read this email. It's just really incredible. The next news item: a group of former pilots have renewed a call for further UFO investigation.
Uh-huh. This is an international panel.
An international panel
of 24 former pilots and government officials called on the U.S. government to reopen the UFO investigations like they did many, many years ago during the Project Blue Book days. Now, why they're not, you know, insisting that maybe governments all over the world, since it is an international panel, come forth on all of their collective reports, I'm not sure. But they seem to be insisting that the U.S. government perhaps is still hiding things, and we've got to get to the bottom of this. The panelists are from seven countries, including former senior military officers. That said, they each had seen a UFO or conducted an official investigation into UFO phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that you know, and that kind of leads me to question: do these people, you know, really have some sort of predisposition towards this? And what is, I don't know, there's an underlying agenda here.
Yeah, I mean, they're UFO believers. I mean, they think that we need more investigation. Yeah, you know, because if you believe in UFO, if you believe that, you know, we're being visited by aliens flying around in spacecraft, and the evidence that the investigations that have taken place so far are not enough to convince you that this is probably not true, then you just want endless investigation. This is a typical ploy, you know, to just continually request more investigation. Because it's hard, it's easy to present this as being the reasonable position. All we're asking is that we investigate, right?
Right.
One of them said, quoted in this article that we'll link to, especially after the attacks of 9/11, it is no longer satisfactory to ignore radar returns, which cannot be associated with performances of existing aircraft and helicopters. That's what the group said in their news conference. So, yeah, they're just trying to invoke, yeah, really, after 9/11, we really got to, you know, put more time into investigating UFOs.
It says in this article that Jimmy Carter claimed to see a UFO.
Yep, they're still trotting out Jimmy Carter's UFO claim, which, of course, we put to rest in our personal interview with the former president.
Yeah, funny they didn't track down Jimmy Carter to ask him his opinion on that.
Right.
there's another quote here from John Callahan, a former Federal Aviation Administration investigator. And he's quoted as saying, "It's a question of who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or the government?"
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really even sure what that means.
Well, first of all, that's a false dichotomy.
Right.
Right, and they're trying to say that, you know, you should believe your own eyes over the government, you know, the government who we know has to be lying. So it's also an appeal to conspiracy thinking, or, you know, it's also a type of ad hominem where it's saying the premise is the government always lies, and therefore you can't believe anything that the government says, right? So it's setting up that false dichotomy. You're going to believe the always lying government or your own eyes.
That's right.
Now, the Air Force has responded. Right. They say,
yep.
Since the termination of Project Blue Book, nothing has occurred that would support a resumption of UFO investigations.
Surprising. And for those of you, for those of you who don't know, for a little history lesson, Project Blue Book was a series of systematic studies on UFOs conducted by the U.S. Air Force. It started in 1952. It concluded in December 1969. the Condon report, which was a commission put together by the government to analyze the reports, revealed that there was no phenomenon at all. Everything was explainable. There was no cases that were that could be deemed unexplained, and they shut down the project because it was not yielding anything constructive in the way of identifying anything as extraterrestrial.
Yeah, right.
What did they examine? 12,500 cases, I think they examined?
Yeah, 12,618.
But no amount of investigation is sufficient, right? It's like the ESP crowd, you know. You could study for 100 years and come up with nothing, and they're still not satisfied.
Yeah, but Steve, they don't think that nothing has been come up with. That's the thing. They're manufacturing information.
Well, this is part of the cover up. This is all part of the conspiracy theory. And
well, that's the other angle of this with the UFO movement, Jay, that you're alluding to, is that there is a conspiracy angle. So, in addition to saying like we need more research, there's this endless pleas to like pressure the government to finally tell the truth. You know, that's sort of their angle on always wanting, you know, more inquiry, you know.
And then one thing I want to throw in there, that it seems every article I read about this has a comment like this. It said that regarding the UFOs, it said, most turn out to be misidentified aircraft, satellites, or meteors. Yeah. A panelist who once worked for Britain's Ministry of Defense said 5% of incidents cannot be explained. Well, of course, they never say it the way that should be said, was that there were 5% of the incidents did not have enough information to make a conclusion one way or the other.
Right.
But they say it cannot be explained, making you think, there's a small percentage, there's something there.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, there's that repeat thing we see all the time where they go, you know, it's like the person that looks at UFO pictures. Well, most of them are fake, you know.
Yeah.
Most of them are fake, so they throw in that skepticism to reinforce what their false positive.
Yeah, right. It's false skepticism in order to create the impression of legitimacy.
Right.
See, I admit that there are fake ghost photos, there are fake psychics, there are fake, you know, UFOs. But then there's the residue of real ones that are truly mysterious.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, the other thing is there's always going to be a residue. The premise that they're implying here is that if we weren't being visited by aliens, that 100% of sightings should be explainable. That's not a fair or legitimate criterion. But what there are, and it's also since we're counting logical fallacies here, it's also the argument from ignorance. They're saying because we can't explain these few cases that there must be something to it. But there's no cases where there's positive evidence for an alien phenomenon.
It's the UFO of the gaps.
Right, it is. It's the aliens of the gaps. Next news item is a bit of astronomy. It appears, as published in the October 20th issue of Astrophysical Journal, that the universe has lost some weight.
Thank God somebody has.
Rebecca, you actually blogged about this today, or yesterday.
So there was a recent paper published that says that basically the universe, or what we can measure of it, doesn't weigh quite as much as we thought it did. And this is all coming from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. And some researchers found that the X-rays that were coming from a certain galaxy, they thought that it was heavy dust and gases reflecting it, but it actually is coming from photons and electrons, which don't weigh quite as much. And figuring out if there's less matter, there's less dark matter, and adding it all up, they are thinking that the universe actually weighs 10 to 20% less than previously estimated.
But that assumes that this finding with the galaxy cluster Able actually is true generally throughout the universe.
Right.
But that's probably a pretty good assumption. But that is what they're assuming at this point. Obviously, they'll take more observations to confirm.
Are there any implications to that? You know, does that increase or decrease the speed in which the universe is expanding, or are we an open universe still? Or?
Well, I would think it would increase the expansion rate if there's less gravity tugging at it, slowing down the rate of expansion. Then the rate of expansion would, you know, maybe would be affected by the less gravity. And I think it's pretty generally well concluded, Jay, that it's definitely an open universe. Especially, I mean, the final nail in that coffin was the discovery that the increasing speed of expansion of the universe. Once that was discovered, that That was one of the most significant astronomical findings of the past century, I think.
Yeah, but to be clear, Bob, to be clear, you're not saying that we're going to revise our calculations about the rate of the expansion of the universe. That is what it is based upon independent observation, right? So we're just observing the expansion of the universe, and it is what it is. The fact that there is less matter in the universe than we previously thought revises our calculations. I think that stems from that, but I think that probably what that will most directly affect is our calculation about dark energy, right? So I guess we need less dark energy to account for the expansion if there's less gravity pulling inward, right? But and dark energy is kind of a fudge factor to begin with. You know, it's something that we're assuming is there because this is what we're observing, and we can't account for it on the basis of what is already known about how the forces in the universe, right?
Real quick, one thing I think I was trying to drive at was that could this also perhaps affect how we calculate the future evolution of the expansion as well?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, the thing about this paper is that, I mean, I read about it through this article, and so I posted on my blog about it, and a couple of astronomers brought up the point that the article that was written wasn't quite in line with the actual science that's going behind the paper.
Yeah, and you're right. Then this is a new news item, and of course we always have to wait for the peer review process to put it through the mill and see what everyone else says about it. And just reading the comments on your blog, Rebecca, what they're essentially saying is one point that I made, which is that they're just taking this observation of this one galaxy cluster and then they're applying it to the observable universe. So you have to assume that that's correct. But they're also getting very technical, saying that you have to make assumptions about the way in which we estimate the mass of things based upon these X-ray findings. So it may be true that the conclusions of this paper don't hold up when astronomers and cosmologists start tearing into it like this. You're right.
Or even not necessarily the conclusions of the paper might be faulty, but that there was something lost in the translation between the paper and the science writer who wrote the article, which happens a lot of times when things become overly simplified from we observed something coming from a certain galaxy and that somehow translates into the universe just lost weight.
Right.
Congratulations,
right.
She's down a dress size. So, yeah.
Yep, that's a good point. The next news item is about a petition that has just been filed for the FDA. Now, the petition tries to disguise itself as concern for the safety of drugs. So this is a petition that they're claiming would protect the public from dangerous drugs. But you know what it is really about?
Vaccines?
Nope. This is a thinly disguised animal rights activism. That's what
Ooh,
this is.
Really?
So they filed this today for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And this is an international coalition of scientists and doctors seeks to compel the agency to stem the flood of dangerous drugs reaching American consumers. What crap. That is not what this is about at all. This is mega, mega spin. The coalition spokesman, John Pippin, writes, "Dangerous drugs are killing American consumers because regulators allow drug companies to use misleading animal tests." Bing, that's what
Steve,
it's all
Steve, this
about.
Is very funny that you bring this up because in my research for my blog and something we're going to talk about later in the show, Scientologists actually push this crap. They're anti-animal research because they're anti- drugs, which are and the ultimate goal, is they're anti-psychiatry.
So they just jump on the anti, animal bandwagon because it's anti-drug.
That's part of their strategy,
and by extension, that's anti-psychiatry, right? Pippin goes on to say the Food and Drug Administration could avert these tragedies by focusing on human-centered methods. I mean, so the wording itself is very emotive and very fear-mongering. We're killing American consumers and these are tragedies that are happening. The core of their claims are is that the system for getting drugs to market for humans involves a phase of animal testing, and we decide how lethal drugs are by testing them in animals and what their side effects are, what their drug-drug interactions are, what their pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. We basically learn as much as we can about drugs from test tube and animal studies, and then we use that information to decide if they should even be used in human trials and then to design those human trials. But then they go on to human trials, right? And phase 1, 2, 3, and then even post-marketing or phase 4 human trials before they get FDA. You have to succeed in phase 3 human trials before you can get FDA approval. So the criticism that animal testing is allowing dangerous drugs to get to consumers is absurd on its face. That's just pure propaganda. They even contradict themselves in their own propaganda. They say more than 90% of drugs tested in people after successful animal tests are not approved for wider use because they don't work and they are unsafe. That's right. 90% of the drugs that get past animal testing don't ever get to the American consumer. So what are they even talking about? They directly contradict themselves. This is all about getting rid of the animal testing as part of the development of pharmaceutical agents. Now, they incorrectly argue that there are more effective methods, but there's absolutely no evidence for the alternative methods that they advocate. They say that we could use...
Microdosing? That was one, wasn't it? Microdosing?
Microdosing is one, which which is absolutely nonsense. There's only so much you could learn about microdosing. Drug toxicity and side effects, all biological effects are totally dose dependent, and you cannot just extrapolate to higher doses.
Right.
So whereas that might add a little bit of information, that is not does not replace animal studies. They also mentioned tissue studies, which again is already part of preclinical studies.
Oh my God.
It's already part of it. And then here's the other one, virtual drug trials.
Virtual drug trials.
That surprised even me. I mean, that is so not ready for prime time that I can't believe they're even mentioning that.
No, that's ridiculous. So we're going to use a computer model of how drugs are going to act in a complex biological system. No way. The bottom line is this. Drug companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars developing drugs. And yeah, most of the drugs they develop don't actually get to market. So they're looking for any way they could possibly improve their ability to predict which chemicals are going to become marketable drugs. And what these people are saying is that the drug companies are relying upon unreliable or bad methods. Why would they be doing that? If there were better methods available, they would use them because it would save them hundreds of millions of dollars. This is a situation in which the free market pressures, definitely are going to optimize the process of drug development because so much money is on the line. So their claims make absolutely no sense. And again, their petition is a farce. It's just ideological. It's just their ideology is animal research is bad. And again, I'm not even commenting on that ideology. I mean, people can have the ethical belief that animal research is unethical. I'm not even addressing that point. That's fine. People can have whatever ethic they want. But this is I think despicable because they're not being upfront that they're advocating for animal rights. They're phrasing the whole thing as if they're protecting the public from dangerous drugs. It's ridiculous.
Peel it away, and you're right. I mean, look at this. Coalitions are the Association of Veterinarians for Animal Rights, British Union for Abolition of Vivisection, Defense of Animals, New England Anti-Vivisection Society.
Yeah.
You don't get to that till you get to the last sentence.
Right,
they list the
associations, the coalition, right. And we're going to end on a lighthearted news item. We've got a lot of emails from a lot of our listeners. Yeah, we always appreciate it when you email us news items. It helps us scour the world for interesting news items, the more people we have sending it to us. So continue to do that. And many people pointed us to a local news story, which was then later picked up by CNN, regarding a ghost caught on video.
So yeah, this is probably the longest ghost video ever recorded. It was interesting ghost. I have to say it's kind of a unique ghost. A Marathon gas station near Cleveland on Sunday night experienced a blue phantom floating around the gas tanks for quite a while. And take a look. We'll have the link on our notes page, and definitely take a look. The owner, his name is Amid Abuzaria, said that he actually watched it for 30 minutes, and then when he saw it move, he got freaked out.
Now, Bob, when you say he watched it, you mean he watched it on the video?
Yeah, there's
on the security camera, not in,
right.
In the real world.
And that's actually a very key point. There's a security camera watching the gas tanks, and that's what pretty much, as far as I could tell, that's how everybody has seen this thing. Nobody seems to have seen it actually face-to-face, and I was really kind of surprised that this guy would watch this ghost, a blue ghost, floating around his gas station for a half hour and never once peek outside.
Yeah, that's odd, to say the least.
Some of the big theories are someone claimed that it was an angel. Another guy said that it was...
it's the blue angel, right?
The blue angel. Nice.
Another guy claimed that he's lived in the area for many decades, and he believes that the gas station was built on an Indian burial ground.
Isn't all of North America a Indian burial ground?
Right. So what you see this...
It's like a light electric blue blob. Or you know, like a cloud almost looking object,
or like an out of focus chunk of blue plastic.
No, actually, my theory is that it is an insect. Look at this video. Look at the movements. Look how it orients itself and moves around. To me, it's classic insect movements. And
I'm just going to throw this out there. Is it possible that it's an insect that died and came back from the dead to haunt the gas station?
That's
insect of ghosts.
Ancient Indian insect, in fact.
Yes,
Indian insect ghost. But Bob, I do have to disagree with you. I think that the blue is too artificial to be an insect and too uniform. And hang on, your main line of evidence, Bob, is that it's moving in a bug-like fashion. But I think that's because of the very highly low frame rate of the video source.
I realize that, and I try to take that into account. But if you see how it orients itself, it definitely seems to have a head, the way it moves around, and it seems to be oriented in the plane of the lens of the camera.
Exactly.
The way it moves and shifts, it's in that plane. It never seems to be outside of that plane.
If you take a look at the video again and then just superimpose the idea that it is moving on a plane, all of a sudden it doesn't look like it's in a 3D situation anymore.
So do you think it's attached to the lens?
I think it's walking on the lens.
It's walking on the lens cover. A few more points, Steve. First off, I think it moves like a bug. Secondly, mm-hmm. it remains a constant size. This thing does not seem to get any significantly at all bigger or smaller, like it's moving away or towards the camera. And it does not move behind any objects. If this thing moves
behind
anything,
it's very close to the lens. That's a good point, but here's the others have pointed this out, so this is not original to me, but I agree with it, that it could be either a chunk of blue fuzz or a chunk of blue plastic that is clinging to the lens by static electricity and then just bouncing around on the lens
from
the wind.
That's an insect. Take a look at it again, Steve.
Okay, I'm going to put this one out there. What if it's a blue plastic insect that died and came back to haunt
the
gas station?
You hit it.
Rebecca, you keep working on these pet theories of yours. You'll hit something soon.
Trust me, I'm an expert.
Insect or blue plastic / fuzz?
I vote bug. Evan votes bug.
It would be really cool if one of our listeners that happened to live near there just took a drive by and took a picture of the camera.
Marathon Pleasant Gas Station, Valley. Parma, Ohio. Parma, Ohio.
We've got to have some people in Parma, Ohio.
That'd be cool.
I mean, some on-site
investigation. Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love someone to check it out.
Evan, we also need some high-tech video assessment. We need to... You know, on those TV shows where they just say, can you get that in better resolution? And they hit a button, and then whatever is fuzzy and low res becomes magically high res. Yeah,
there you go.
I'm Skyping NASA right now to order that. So
Thank you.
You're welcome.
While you're doing that, let's move on to your questions and emails. First question comes from Joe in Long Island, New York, and he writes, hey guys, I'm a big fan of the podcast, and I just wanted to make a point about the study that seemed to show that being overweight was healthier than being normal weight. So here goes. I believe BMI, which is body mass index, was the standard used. It's important to note that BMI does not take into account body fat versus skeletal muscle. This is relevant, as Dr. Novella said, something along the lines that the study may show that having a layer of fat might be healthy. This is not necessarily true as a person that has higher than normal muscle mass may have a BMI that is considered overweight. In fact, athletes commonly stray into the overweight BMI range. Thank you for that email, Joe. We had many emails, actually, about that point. And there also was a lively discussion on the boards, on the forums, about this very point. And what Joe says is correct. And I thought I would talk for just a second about the body mass index and why it is used. That was the standard that was used on the study we discussed last week, which showed that people in the overweight category of BMI actually had the lowest death rate or the highest survival rate. The question is, what does, you know, how useful is BMI as a measure of how fat someone is? And while I think that those who pointed out the weaknesses of BMI are correct, I don't think that invalidates its utility in these types of studies for several reasons. Now, the reason that BMI is used is because it's really easy. It's essentially height and weight. All you need is those two pieces of information. And height and weight are, you know, they're easily measured numbers, and they're usually very objectively recorded, even in like routine information for hospital visits or for many situations. So it's information that is readily available about many people in many situations, and that makes it a very convenient measure when you want to do massive epidemiological studies of thousands or tens of thousands of people. There are more sophisticated measures of body fat, like the body fat percentage, but these are more difficult to do. There's some technique involved. Like you could use using calipers to measure the thickness of subcutaneous fat, but that, you know, there's a lot of variability in technique there, and also as different types of fat distribution will give you completely different measures. Like, for example, somebody who has a pot belly may have a lot of truncal obesity, but you can't really get a fold of fat because it's not loose. So their measurement would be completely off. So that method isn't perfect either. And then there are still more sophisticated measurements. But again, the more sophisticated you get...
Hydrostatic weighing?
Yeah, right. But underwater. The more sophisticated you get, the more difficult it is and the less available it's going to be if you want to do on tens of thousands of people. So it's mainly
do you know what the most accurate way is?
What is that?
Autopsy.
Autopsy, is that right? That's also the maximally inconvenient method.
Yeah.
And so there is this inverse relationship between convenience and difficulty in obtaining the numbers. So that's why it's used. And the weakness is that it looks at only height and weight. So if you're really muscular, you'll have more weight for your height, and that might put you in the overweight or even the obese category if you're very muscular. But so that's not a good measure of body fat. And that was actually acknowledged in the study that we discussed last week, and that some of the people in the overweight category may have actually been just had more lean, you know, body mass, and therefore we would expect them to be healthier. However, if you're looking across the population, even though it doesn't account for age and sex and body type, it does kind of average out over large numbers. So even though it's very crude, when you're dealing with large numbers, it mainly averages out. And it has been used in a lot of studies, and it does correlate consistently, for example, with increased risk of diabetes and heart disease and cholesterol and things like that. So there is some validity to the BMI. And the fact that it has these weaknesses does not mean it has no utility in these types of studies. And also you have to think about it this way as well. And a lot of the criticism is focused on the fact that the BMI may have absolutely no legitimacy when you apply it to an individual person, and that's absolutely correct. For any one person, their BMI may be completely misleading, as I said, but the fact that it doesn't apply to an individual doesn't mean that it doesn't have any utility when you're averaging it out over tens of thousands of people. So the two contexts are not analogous. So the next email is my promised Name That Logical Fallacy. This email is from the listener who writes, "Steve, I forwarded today's neurological blog to a fundamentalist religious friend of mine, and this was his reply. Amazing, as though science has an agenda regarding evolution." This is from listener Eric. And this is the response to my blog from his fundamentalist friend. And he says, "I don't even know if we're going to be able to get all the way through. We can just sort of pick apart things as we go. Here's his first paragraph. That is a very good example of a species that could indeed be a transitional form." Again, we're referring to Tiktaalik, the transitional form between fish and amphibians. Do they have the entire creature in fossil form? I see part of a head. So on the blog, I had just as a graphic of the head of the animal. Already you could see sort of building a case of dismissing this as evidence. So how much of it do we have? Well, we have much more than the head, by the way. He could have found that out on his own. And he writes, I know that Piltdown Man, which we studied in high school, was all fabricated from a pig's molar. I could never figure out how they knew what this guy's wife looked like if all they had was one tooth. Very zealous, in my opinion. So that is a huge false premise. First of all, he studied Piltdown Man in high school.
How long ago was that?
Yeah, that was like before this guy was born. That was rejected. This guy's like 50. And Piltdown Man was, you know, we found out that was a fraud.
40s, I thought.
Yeah, I thought in the 40s. So
maybe he went to a really, really backwards school.
Yeah, so 60 years ago. Yeah, I guess it was a really, really bad school.
Well, Steve, I got the impression that he studied the Piltdown hoax in high school.
Yeah, maybe, but he's making it seem like that, you know, he was taught in high school that Piltdown Man was legitimate, and now we know that was...
Oh, 1953 it was exposed as a forgery.
In 1953, okay. And also, he says it was fabricated from a pig's molar. That's the Nebraska Man, not Piltdown. So he has the wrong Piltdown,
sorry.
Yeah, the Piltdown Man was joining a jaw, a mandible with a skull.
It was an orangutan separate skull with, yes, a human jaw. That's right.
Right.
But he's trying to use that to say that's evolutionary scientists are zealous. His next paragraph is, ID people, again, ID is intelligent design, ID people look at this little guy and go, so what? This could just as easily be explained as a creature that God created with these features, and the creature has no ancestors and never changed since it first appeared. This is a moving the goalpost fallacy. So creationists say there are no transitional forms. And then we say, well, okay, here's Tiktaalik, an obviously beautifully, exquisitely transitional form between fish and amphibians. And they move the goalpost by saying, well, so what? God could have created that. You can't prove that was actually an ancestor, right, and a descendant, that it was actually transitional. So they just move the goalpost to what? You know, to an impossible standard. Mm. It's also, looking at it the other way, they are rendering... This is also why creationism and intelligent design are not science, because they're not falsifiable for this reason, because you could say that about anything that you find. You could say, so what? God created that. So what? It doesn't mean anything. So since if Tiktaalik is not evidence for evolution or does not falsify creation or ID, nothing will. And therefore, all he's done is succeeded in rendering the intelligent design non-falsifiable. He also, by the way, if you read my blog, you'll see that he 100% missed the actual point of my blog entry today, which was to say that not only is Tiktaalik a beautifully transitional fossil, but what they on the Judgment Day program, what they showed, which is really cool, is that the paleontologists actually were looking for it when they found it. They were looking for it because they said that a creature like this should exist in this time and place.
Yeah, they predicted it.
They predicted it, not just
predicted
that,
the discovery. They,
yeah, they weren't just looking for fossils and found this. They said,
"Wow,
you know, there's a gap between fish and amphibians. There has to be in the late Devonian creatures that were transitional between fish and amphibians. The first, you know, walking fish. They must exist in this strata. They went to that strata in northern Canada and they found it." They found exactly what they predicted they should find there.
Which is a hallmark.
Science.
Which is a hallmark of science, right there. They make a prediction, and not only did they find it, but it just totally, you know, yet another vindication of evolutionary theory.
Yeah, it doesn't get better than that. I mean, it really. And he obviously completely missed that point. Let me just do one more paragraph, and I think then we'll be done with this guy. He also wrote, if all creatures evolved from a very simple life form, then we would expect to see mostly transitional forms in the fossil record and very little variety. That's a false premise. To me, there are many more gaps than transitions and way too much variety. So I'm not even really sure what he's talking about here, because I guess he's saying that if you started with one simple form, that there shouldn't be the amount of variety that we see today, which is, the argument from personal incredulity. He's saying that his gut instinct about how much variety there should be if evolution were true
over billions
is not
of
what
years.
We see. Or even just considering multicellular life over 550 million years. How would he know how much variety there should be with 550 million years of multicellular evolution, given the number of environments and niches that we have had on the Earth over that period of time? How could you make any kind of gut instinct, even ballpark guess at what that should be?
The Bible?
That's just, really just personal incredulity. Just has no basis for that whatsoever. And he says there are more gaps than transitions. Again, what does he mean by that? This gets back to the definition of a transitional form. Every fossil is transitional. Every single species is transitional because everything is somewhere between other species.
I'm not.
No, you're the pinnacle.
You're the pinnacle. That's right. You're the pinnacle.
Rebecca is always transitioning either to getting drunk or getting sober.
That's true.
I prefer getting drunk or getting drunker. Those are my transitional stages.
Ah, evolution.
Well, thanks, Eric, for giving us our Name That Logical Fallacies this week. And let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Paul Kurtz. Paul, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Very glad to be with you, Steve.
And Paul Kurtz is a professor emeritus of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo, and he is the chairman for the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry and the Council for Secular Humanism. He's also the editor-in-chief of Free Inquiry magazine. And essentially, Paul, you are one of the founding members of the modern skeptical and humanist movements.
Yes, indeed, of both of them. And the Committee for a Skeptical Inquiry used to be known as PSYCOP.
That's right, formerly PSYCOP. That's
right. The Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, which is a big term.
So you have spent the bulk of your career, your adult life, working very tirelessly towards skepticism and humanism as a unified attempt at transforming culture and society. I think really nothing less than that.
Yes, that's an awesome task, but that's true.
So tell me first of all, what is your philosophy to which you are trying to push our society and our culture?
Well, I'm focusing on critical thinking, the development of critical thinking, and an appreciation of the methods of science. Because so much of the changes occurring on the planet are due to science and technology. So that's the first part, and skepticism is part of the method of inquiry. And I'm attempting to apply that to ethical values, and that's humanism. Mm-hmm. And there's a great disparity between our moral beliefs and the values, which were handed down from the past, and the scientific advance. So bringing skepticism and humanism together in some sense.
And you've been doing this now for several decades. I think PSYCOP...
Well, a half a century. I go back a long time, so at least a half a century.
So I think 1976 is when PSYCOP was formally founded. Is that correct?
Yeah, I founded that in 1976, but I founded Prometheus Books, which is the leading skeptical and humanist press in the world.
So how after that much time, how do you think we're doing?
Well, I'm an optimist about the long-range development of humans on this planet, and I think if you look back on the 20th century, there's been enormous progress. Now, obviously, there are wild beliefs and myths that persist, and so every generation needs to apply the critical eye. But I see constant progress in human civilization everywhere virtually on the planet.
So you think in general things are getting better and that we're actually winning this cultural war, if you will?
Well, they get worse and they get better. So, two steps forward, one step backwards, as was said. I just returned from China, and wow, to see what the Chinese are doing and how rapidly they're progressing is very encouraging. So this is a kind of global perspective.
What is your view? I know this is a bit of an aside, but since you're just returning from China, what is your view of the Chinese culture and how they're dealing with these issues of secularism and humanism?
Well, China is the oldest continuous culture on the planet, and they've survived for over 4,000 years, so they have long tradition going back to Confucianism. They are basically interested in cultivating skepticism, and they're interested in a humanist society. Now, I realize that a communist government is in place there, but nonetheless, there are very rapid changes occurring, and the growth rate is phenomenal. The effort to increase education and health is extraordinary. So it's quite an amazing 1.3 billion people on the planet. It's quite an amazing country.
So even under their current communist government, you think that they are interested and dedicated to promoting free inquiry and skepticism?
Well, not free inquiry as much as I want, and not skepticism as much as I want, but at least a humanist concern for harmony.
Doctor, in what capacity were you there?
Well, the Center for Inquiry, which I head up, and which includes both skepticism and humanism, has organized a center in Beijing, and we had a congress of centers for inquiry. So they invited us, and we were exploring common planetary problems, such as global warming, pollution, and the great disparities in income and wealth.
Now, on the secular humanism website, there is a secular humanist declaration on there, and I was interested to see that you are asking for a democratic secular humanism, that you tie it directly to democracy.
And secular, non-religious, and humanistic. And I think as we're have entered into the 21st century, these problems are planetary. So it's a planetary democratic secular humanism, finding new solutions based on science and reason, and attempting to work out new moral values that we can share throughout the planet.
Yeah, and the thing that I think has really defined all these various endeavors that you're engaged in is that it always has seemed to me that you're trying to unite all of these things under a common single philosophy. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I believe in pluralism, and I believe in multi-secularism. So there are obviously different cultures and different traditions on the planet, but now we have to find common ground. I mean, science, and I know, Steve, you're a great person in science and have done research and practicing scientist. Science is a bridge between cultures, and that's the bridge that brought a team to China. So it's a need to find commonalities, science, perhaps universal values if possible, loving concern with the environment and other species. It's totally interdependent today, and no one country can exist in isolation, least of all the United States.
Mm-hmm. So you really see that this has to be a worldwide movement to really succeed, almost by definition?
Well, planetary civilization is upon us. It is planetary. I mean, communication is instantaneous. In China, almost everybody I saw had a cell phone. In fact, everybody took my photograph. And Shanghai, the last city we visited, it looked like Manhattan with huge skyscrapers. So whatever happens any place happens everywhere. So that it's truly instantaneous communication, knowledge, and shared values. And so that's what we need to find, shared values.
Let's turn back to the United States a little bit, because certainly there's been a lot of controversy in the last 7 or 8 years in this country in terms of the relationship between politics and science.
And, yes, indeed.
And that is the intersection there between politics and science is, again, certainly something that you confront.
Well, I think there has been a culture war. Our work, the Center for Inquiry and our various organizations, are committed to the scientific outlook, and we're disturbed that the United States seems to be falling behind in this endeavor, and there have been efforts to whittle away at science. There are tremendous anti-scientific attitudes cultivated in the media, and then a reversion to some of the fundamentalist religions. So that is disturbing. The political ideological undermining of science. I think scientific research should be free. The best illustration, Steve, is in stem cell research, mm-hmm. where the United States has fallen behind because of moral theological reasons.
So what would you say in the United States, what would you say is, I know this is always an unfair question because it's complicated, but is there any one or two things that stick out as the greatest threats to society that are based in irrationality?
Well, I think it's scientific illiteracy, that's first, and the failure of the public to appreciate the scientific outlook. I mean, look at what's happening in astronomy. I mean, it blows the mind. We've discovered 250 new planets in the last 5 years. Now, people have heard about that, but do they and can they appreciate that? That we are a species on a minor planet in one galaxy among billions? So the cosmic outlook of science really needs to be appreciated. And the methods by which we understand it, yes. Cultivation of rationality is the best guarantee of democracy. The educated citizen needs to be informed. And yet in the U.S. we have creationism, intelligent design, and other theories trying to block scientific education.
Right.
And that's deplorable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, because we confront things like that, and it seems as if, like, creationism just morphs from one version to the next, and it never seems to go away, and the polling numbers don't seem to make any progress when you ask, like, the number of people in the United States that believe in evolution versus accept creationism or intelligent design. So I think that's probably why, especially some of the newer or the younger people getting involved with skepticism and humanism may be under the impression that this is a battle that we're losing. And yet you still think that if you take a longer view that we're moving in a positive direction.
Yeah, well, you know, it's totally embarrassing to go abroad. I've been to 60 countries on the planet, and to see that the U.S. of the great industrial democratic countries, there's less belief in Darwin than almost anywhere else on the planet, except backward. There are backward countries in Africa. And the Middle East, Asia, and so on. But nonetheless, so the failure, why have we failed? The failure of the mass media, the failure of the schools, and the failure of this administration to really take scientific advance seriously and the implications for the betterment of the human species. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, so how can we do a better job of improving scientific literacy if that seems to be the linchpin of all of these related endeavors?
Well, a very good question, Steve, and I don't have a single answer, but I think we need a new enlightenment in the United States. The public needs to be informed. I'm disturbed by the banality on television, the violence and the vulgarity and the mass media. I think there's a responsibility, and I think we need within, and now you've played a key role in the skeptics movement, so we need as skeptics, as scientists, as citizens, to constantly try to raise the level of taste and appreciation. Mm-hmm. And that's an awesome task, but it has to be done.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and it's sometimes...
And incidentally, on this point, especially our political leaders, if you look at some of the debates, I'd love to see a debate on the role of science in public policy.
Well, maybe you could host that debate with the president.
Well, we'd like that. I don't know if they'd be willing, but would also be such a debate. Incidentally, we have an Office of Public Policy, that is the Center for Inquiry, in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and we're committed to science, scientific integrity, and also secularism, separation of church and state against, let us say, undue religious influence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a political battle, but it's basically the battle of education, and it's a battle in a democracy to raise the level of the debate.
And yet it still seems like we have an uphill fight on our hands.
Well, it's an uphill fight, but as I said, long range, I'm an optimist.
Right.
I mean, in the 20th century, lifespans have been increased. I'm an octogenarian myself. Mm-hmm. When I was a younger man, someone was old when he was 60, so I'm past 80. but lifespans have been extended, and education has been widened. So there are so many advances that we've made since the year 1900, mm-hmm. in the last 100 years, and I think that will continue to continue in medicine and neurology, in the natural and social sciences, and in mm-hmm. other fields as well.
Yeah, and I think that's always been the dilemma for me. That so, yeah, I think that science does work. As Sagan said, it delivers the goods, and that is a tremendous long-term advantage culturally for science. And I think that I agree with you on that. That's why I'm primarily optimistic for the future as well.
Yeah.
And yet, on the short term, the 10 or 20 years, you know, a generation.
You know, there are short term.
Yeah,
there are always crises. You know,
yeah.
There are always problems, and people wring their hands. But I lived through the Great Depression, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and now the Iraqi War. So there are always difficulties, and you mustn't be overwhelmed by them. It seems to me the best antidote to nonsense is reason and education and critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And alas, often it's forgotten.
A couple of linked questions. If the first one is, looking back over the last 30, 40 years of the skeptical and humanist movements, have you learned anything that would make, if you would go back in time, if it was 1960 right now, would you do something dramatically different than what you did? Or do you think that, you know, you fought the best fight and this is the outcome, the best outcome we could have hoped for? Or something in between?
One thing that I learned is that many of these myths and illusions that dominate in society, they're like unsinkable rubber ducks. And so you have to constantly be vigilant. You need constantly to provide a skeptical eye, but not in a negative sense, in a positive sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I'm especially disturbed about today is the failure of idealism. I think that we need ideals of the future and of constant improvement, and you don't find that to the extent that, let's say, we had even 40, 50 years ago of mm-hmm. creating a better world.
So do you think that, just to bring it back to my question, that there hasn't been enough optimism or idealism, rather, within the skeptical movement?
Idealism, yes, ideals.
Yeah.
We don't live by bread alone. We need ideals. And we need, if you will, images of a better future. I have that, and I see a progressive improvement in the human condition.
So what's your advice for those of us who are active in the skeptical movement, just the movement as a whole? Where do we go from here? If we had to look at the next 50 years, what do you think is the most important thing for us to do?
Yes, a very good question. It seems to me there are always new problems. And you have to be willing to accept it. I mean, that's life. There are always problems. You shouldn't be overwhelmed by that. People come to me, young people, they wring their hands. Oh, this is so bad, and that's so bad, and what are we going to do? I said, have courage. Well, the thing that I would most emphasize, Steve, is that we need alternatives. We're not debunkers.
Mm-hmm.
We can't destroy. So we need new ideals, new values for the future, and constantly work to improve the human condition. So I think destiny, in one sense, is within our power.
Mm-hmm.
So with some realistic optimism, the use of the methods of critical thinking and science, but yes, the willingness to find new ideals that we can share in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so skepticism has to contribute to optimistic humanism.
And what do you think about the brand of skepticism? Just, I mean, my sense is that it's getting better, but we still have a long way to go. Do you think that we're doing a good job improving the brand, the public perception of skepticism, or do you think maybe we need to morph into something else?
Well, no, I think we have much more to do. Incidentally, 30 years ago, you never heard the word skepticism. Now it's entered into the language, so we've revived this classical Greek or Roman concept. It came back with the dawn of modern science, with Galileo and Descartes and many others. And so you always have to have a critical eye. But it's not negative and destructive, because skepticism contributes to the growth of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have reliable knowledge.
So you're happy with the skeptical brand and the way that that's going?
Well, let's say that I think we've made a lot of progress, yes. And skepticism was not really well appreciated but we have a long way to go yet.
Yeah.
I think we need courses in the universities on critical thinking. That's very important. And I would say courses on humanistic values. New ethics needs to develop a planetary ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be an awareness of the opportunities for improving life for everyone on the planet.
So there's one topic that's been very controversial within the skeptical movement, and you and I have been actually on opposite sides of this controversy, and that is the degree to which skeptical activism needs to occur hand in hand with secular humanism. I have chosen to focus my efforts purely on what I call scientific skepticism, and you have felt it's very important that the two things actually operate together, and that has been an enduring controversy within the skeptical movement.
Yes.
And so how has that affected your
no,
two
I agree.
Organizations?
They're two separate domains. I think we need to cultivate scientific skepticism, that is methodological naturalism, and appreciation for rigorous methods of testing truth claims with the replication and peer review in every field. And you can do methodological naturalism or scientific skepticism no matter what your other beliefs are as mm-hmm. a specialist. But secular humanism is focusing on another area, and that is the question of ethical values and whether they can only be derived from religion or whether there are alternative sources. And, of course, I hold as a secular humanist that we need to draw on the best knowledge and wisdom of the past in the area of ethics, but that we have to work out new principles and new values
right.
appropriate to the new situation based upon reason and not drawn from the old-time religion.
Right, right.
So that's the difference.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. And it seems to me that when I have this conversation with many people, that it comes down to whether or not you think you can promote methodological naturalism, as you say, which is science is absolutely dependent upon methodological materialism
yes.
and naturalism.
Yes.
And,
well, I prefer the term naturalism
yeah.
because it's non-reductive,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't reduce everything to purely the micro developments in physics and chemistry. That provides enormous understanding.
Right.
There are different levels of understanding in the various sciences.
Would yes. you say that secular humanism is dependent upon or specifically promotes philosophical naturalism? Is that the distinction between science and humanism?
Well, secular humanism is basically a method of inquiry. It wants to use scientific methods to understand nature and solve human problems. But also then it draws upon the cosmic perspective of science. So we're skeptical about religious claims from the past. But then it goes on and tries to apply this to the ethical life. It's what I call ethical, or what is called ethical naturalism.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a larger agenda. I mean, you can be a scientist in a specialized field, and we need that. But if you ask, what's the meaning of life, how I ought to live, what are my values and norms, mm-hmm. then you move into another area of secular humanism, or I call it eupraxy.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is that it's an attempt at addressing the questions that the meaning of life, ethics,
yes.
et cetera, that are traditionally the realm of religion, but doing it from a rationalist, secular point of view.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, our religions of the past were derived from what ancient nomadic and agricultural civilizations believed in, and it was their best conception of the universe, but we've gone far beyond that, mm-hmm. and our expanding our understanding, for example, the theory of evolution, which was
right.
not known to ancients in the same sense it is today,
yeah.
so that our cosmic view has changed and our moral values and the light of that has changed.
Right. Yeah, and yeah. I've seen that is a particular point of contention with the religious community who are rallying around, in my experience, and I've in fact had this directly at me, in fact, around the notion of objective morality, that morality can only be objective if it is based upon the divine, essentially.
Well, so but then how do you explain the fact that they kill each other.
Right.
We were met at the 9/11 site at the New York Academy on the 40th floor, looking down, and the men apparently who destroyed those buildings saying "Allah Akbar, God is great," and they dispute with other people. So basing it upon religion doesn't help us because they kill each other in the name of God.
Right. That's
not, I mean, the religions do disagree. Now, I agree that there is a kernel of wisdom in the great religions, and I read the ancient documents for their eloquence, the literary value, and maybe moral insight. But we have to go beyond religion in the new world, post-industrial information world.
Yeah, it seems to me that the big problem with basing objective morality on the divine is that it claims to base it upon God, but it's really basing it on faith in a human interpretation of
exactly
what somebody claims God is, that he exists and what he's saying.
And so it's really just in the name of God, and they differ and kill each other in the name of God.
Yeah.
As we see the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Christians and the Jews and the Hindus all get into the act, and that's very, very unfortunate, based upon ancient rivalries. So we have to transcend the ancient religious, ethnic, racial, national differences, and it's urgent that we do so, and the dialogue should be based upon the best scientific knowledge that we have and the new ethics appropriate to the 21st century and beyond.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Delighted.
It's been a great conversation.
So. You're one of the best moderators that I've encountered. You're well informed and knowledgeable about the key questions.
Well, thank you. I have to credit a lot of my skeptical training at the hands of Skeptical Inquirer magazine and the movement that you started. I'm a product of the movement that you started, Paul.
Yes.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve, very much.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. And then I challenge my skeptical rogues to tell me which one is the fake. Okay, here we go. Number one. New research shows that your initials subconsciously influence your academic and athletic performance. Item number two. A new study explains how males evolve more quickly than females. And item number three, a new study links exposure to sunlight with an increased risk of cervical cancer. Evan, go first.
Okay. Research shows your initials subconsciously influence your academic and athletic performance. Boy, I'm tempted to say that that's garbage. Males evolve more quickly than females. Okay, I can understand that, I think. New studies like exposure to sunlight with increased risk of cervical cancer. You know, I think the last sunlight and increased risk of cervical cancer is the fiction. I think it's the opposite, if I'm not mistaken. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay. Jay?
Which one did you say was fiction, Evan?
Sunlight and increased risk of cervical cancer.
I don't know about that one with the initials. I mean, I can't think of any reason why your initials would have any effect on, maybe academically, I don't know. And the new study that explains that males evolve more quickly than females, that I can see someone making an excuse for that. I can hear some reasoning behind that. Sunlight increases your vitamin D, and vitamin D either helps or hinders. That's it, where I think that one is. I can see where Evan is going with that, but I think that one is the fake, the initials.
Okay, Bob?
Okay, cue the Monty Python intermission music.
Oh, someone sounds bitter.
No, I didn't. It sounds funny. I haven't listened to it yet, but it sounds pretty funny. I don't care. Okay, number one, the initials. I'm going to agree with that. I'm going to say that is science. Number two, males evolve more quickly than females. I'm going to agree with that one as well. I think the classic example of that is the peacock and how the peacock evolved its beautiful feathers compared to the peahen, which is kind of plain and ugly. Number three, I'm going to have to say I think that is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with the crowd, sadly. The initials influencing your academic and athletic performance seems like it should be fiction, but I do remember reading some older studies that supported that. and males evolving more quickly in females is obviously thrown in there just to throw us off. Because anecdotally, I know that females obviously evolve more quickly for the human species. But I'm pretty sure that that's a fact, as Bob said, the peacock thing. So, yeah, I'm going to go with the cervical cancer one. I think that that's fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that a new study explains how males evolve more quickly than females is science. And that one is, in fact, science. I don't know if you guys read the article, but the peacock peahen thing is the example that is given of sexual selection and, you know, and male species not evolving more quickly than female species. Also, among birds, you know, males evolve more complicated mating calls, etc. And but this the study, so that's true, and the study explains mechanistically how that is true, and it has to do with it is the difference in the sexual chromosomes. So males are XY, and females are XX. That means if you're XY, any mutation in either the X or the Y chromosome is going to be expressed. If you're XX, many mutations will not be expressed because they'll be recessive and they'll be compensated for by the X other X chromosome.
Oh.
So the mutations do not necessarily propagate in, and cause a change in the actual phenotype as quickly. So, Jay, you're out by yourself claiming that new research shows that your initials subconsciously influence your academic and athletic performance. You think that one is the fiction.
Everyone I didn't else, make a claim.
That's your guess, is that that one is the fiction.
That's my guess, yes.
And that one is science.
Oh, well. We all saw that coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
Well, we did.
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting line of research. And Rebecca, you're right. This isn't the first study to show things like this. This was research done by Leif Nelson at the University of California and colleague Joseph Simmons from my own Yale University. What they did was they just looked at large bodies of statistics, you know, where they had where they could correlate the names of people with some performance. And then they hypothesized that the initials would predict the performance with certain patterns. And that pattern is that we are less averse to letters which are related to our own initials. So, for example, they looked at the batter's strikeout percentages in Major League Baseball. And in the statistics, the letter K is used to designate striking out. And what they found was that batters who had whose initial was K had a higher strikeout rate than batters who didn't have the initial K.
Really?
And that was that's what they hypothesized, that's what they would find. I think because the lower aversion to the letter K means they would not work as hard to avoid striking out. And then they did an academic study where they looked at letter grades A, B, C, and D, and they found that, indeed, people who had the A and B letters, initials, A and B initials, got more A's and B's, and people who had the initials C and D got more C's and D's. And they had a lower level of performance.
The reason why I'd heard of this sort of research before was Richard Wiseman's recent book, Quirkology, includes a section on studies done, people with initials that spell out good things, like pleasant three-letter words, tend to do better in life than people whose initials spell out, say, like rat or something not good, you know. So I think it's funny, and I, you know, whenever I see something like that, I my skeptical alarms go off.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we have to be skeptical of these kind of correlation studies, but that's why I thought it was interesting that they actually then did a laboratory study where they, you know, again predicted that, saying on this test, and they would randomly assign the test a letter, you know, that stood for a bad outcome. People whose initials matched that did worse. So that was not just a correlation.
Yeah.
They actually had a study where they had a predicted outcome. So, yeah, no, I think I remember him talking about, and this is also mentioned in this article, that, for example, people named Jack are more likely to live in Jacksonville, you know, than people who are not named Jack. Or people named Phil are more likely to live in Philadelphia.
And what's also, there's jobs. People.
Yeah, like people named Rob are criminals, you know.
Okay.
People.
There you go.
People named Russell rake leaves.
People named Bob Surf.
Right. And people named Rebecca. Well, that one's too obvious.
People named Jack. Well, okay.
Well, people named Neil like to give blowjobs.
Wait, way to spell it out there, Jay.
Don't drag Neil Adams back into this. Come on. Which means...
Well, I think we have a clip for the next uncensored.
Yeah, uncut.
Uncut?
The uncensored Please Don't Sue Us edition.
Which means that a new study links exposure to sunlight with an increased risk of cervical cancer is indeed fiction. And you're right, it is linked to a lower risk of cervical cancer. And not only cervical cancer, but some other types of cancer as well.
See, you flip-flopped it.
I did. And it is a vitamin D thing. It's very interesting. In the last few years, there's been this rash of studies showing that vitamin D is involved with all kinds of diseases, like not only different types of cancer, but also like multiple sclerosis, which is, you know, very, very interesting. So,
wow.
Although you can get vitamin D nutritionally, a lot of the forms of vitamin D are formed in the skin from photosynthesis by the sun, by exposure to sunlight. But sunlight also carries with it a risk for skin cancer. So in every climate, these two opposing evolutionary pressures or selective pressures cause people to have skin that was, you know, dark enough to protect against skin cancer, but light enough in order to produce the sufficient amounts of vitamin D. But now, of course, we have people of all various skin colors living in different parts of the world. So what all of this means is that that's one of those vitamins, that's one vitamin where it appears that there's a lot more deficiency, vitamin D deficiency, than we had previously thought. And even a moderate or a relative amount of vitamin D deficiency actually correlates with a lot of diseases, increased risk of a lot of different diseases. So it's possible that we're, in general, the population is vitamin D deficient, and we need to be paying a lot more attention to this.
Well, how do you determine if you're deficient in vitamin D?
It's got your level measured.
You have rickets.
Well, that's really severe. I mean, you know, severe vitamin D deficiency. We did mainly eradicate rickets by, you know, fortifying milk and
things
like that.
I was kidding. I just wanted to say the word rickets.
You just like to say rickets?
Crickets? It's a good word. Rickets. Almost as funny as scurvy.
Yeah. Scurvy is a great disease name. Like, Captain
it really
Scurvy.
Is.
And this brings us to Evan's magical mystery puzzle.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Last week's puzzle is as such. This alleged sexual abuser of boys was also famous for misusing adults by convincing them of his clairvoyance. His claims.
He sounds chipper when you say that.
Well, it's just, you know, I don't know. I
talk
like
about the abuse more. Sorry, go on.
I don't know. I like how I crafted that line. There's something about it. His claims included the abilities of astral travel to access the Akashic records, and that he could see people on Mars. He is still revered by a great many gullible and forgiving people to be one of the greatest seers of all time. Who is he? The gentleman's name is Charles Webster Ledbetter.
Really?
Yes. Ledbetter. I'm sorry. I should pronounce that correctly. Charles Webster Ledbetter, who was born in 1854, died in 1934, clergyman, author, contributed to the world mostly through his work as an alleged clairvoyant. And, you know, amongst his other claims to fame is that he was brought up on charges of sexual abuse of boys in his time. He was never actually arrested or found guilty.
Never convicted
of it. But, right, never convicted of it, but accused on multiple
occasions.
But he
occasions. Liked the boys.
Yeah, he would, you know, hang around with them a lot, and, you know, it was disturbing reading that part of his history.
So he had a penchant for buggery.
Penchant for buggery and for hokey claims, such as believing that there was a population of humans on the planet Mars.
Evan, did we have a winner?
We did, and our friend Ole Ivind once again.
Ole!
Ole! What's this, about a sixth time he's won? So congratulations on your speedy answer to the puzzle.
Congratulations,
yep. But this week's puzzle, I predict that Ole is not going to get. He's not going to be the first one to answer it correctly, I'll say that.
This week's puzzle is as such. According to legend, at 37 it consumes, at 40 it refrains. Identify the myth.
That's a very, very pithy puzzle this week.
It's not a lot of information to go on, so you're really going to have to stretch your mind.
Yeah, sometimes you give a lot of information, so this is a good change.
Yeah.
Good change up.
Good. So enjoy it, and good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Jay, can you please read for us the quote of the week?
Quote of the week. I'm quoting Carl Sagan again. Those afraid of the universe as it really is, those who pretend to non-existent knowledge and envision a cosmos centered on human beings, will prefer the fleeting comforts of superstition. Carl Sagan!
Good one, Jay.
Thank you, Jay. We're always up for a Carl Sagan quote.
Oh, yeah. A great, astute observer of the human condition.
Well, thank you guys once again.
Steve, I'd like to say that you did a great interview today. I really enjoyed listening to you do that. Perfect.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Yeah, I had a good time, and I've been meaning to interview Paul Kurtz for a long time. I'm glad we had the opportunity to do it, and he was very,
absolutely.
Very gracious.
He's a cool guy.
Yep. And also, on December 8th, so just coming up in a couple of weeks, I will be giving a lecture for the New York City Skeptics. This will take place at the New York Public Library, 425 Avenue of the Americas, from 1 to 4 p.m., and the talk is on skepticism, the skeptical movement, and being a skeptical activist. It's sort of a primer for starting a skeptical group. And to also just discuss all aspects of skepticism. So, thanks again, guys.
You're welcome. Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.